Hello and welcome to the Right Dishonourable podcast, as truthful as resources permit. I just introduced myself after that, don't I?
How have you... this is the 118th time we've done this.
It's been so long.
Go on, try again.
Hello and welcome to the Right Dishonourable podcast, as truthful as resources permit. My name's Jimmy and I voted to leave the EU in 2016.
I'm Jazza and obviously I'm watching the Great British Bake Off because I'm a walking cliche. And I can't help but think that as the contestants get whittled away, that the producers of Channel 4 are trying to create an antidote to Brexit Britain, with the cast now consisting of a French nanny, two people of South Asian origin, a lady with a disability who just won Star Baker, and a Welsh man with two daughters who dress him up in tutus and Hawaiian shirts. It's so adorable and really lovely, and actually just makes me want to feel really British again. It's really nice. I voted to remain.
Didn't the Welsh vote for Brexit? It's the Welsh and the English vote for Brexit, and then Scott.
I have no doubt that out of all of them, he is the one that voted for Brexit.
Okay.
Although I do think he's the only one left who voted for Brexit.
Ah.
But he wears tutus sometimes, so it's fine.
What do you think the overlap is between sort of bakers or cake makers
and cross-dressers? Oh,
and Brexit voters.
Surprisingly high. Lots of old people.
Yeah.
And especially like fans of Great British Bake Off, I feel like that's quite a twee thing.
Mm.
And I got reminded today that London was the only region in England that didn't vote to leave.
Yes.
Which, I mean, that's sobering, isn't it, really? And England is meant to be quite twee, like the villages and baking sales and all of that kind of stuff. And I think that a lot of that overlaps with the Great British Bake Off.
Yes.
Which in America is the Big British Baking Show or something, because they don't know what a bake-off is.
Isn't it pretty self-explanatory?
It is pretty self-explanatory.
I mean, they have dance-offs and stuff in the US, don't they? Like,
right?
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure bake-off came first and dance-offs are derivatives of bake-offs. Stick that in your pipe and smoke it, America. We meet sometimes.
Irregularly.
But persistently,
yes,
to talk about current events, social issues, and politics. This week, we, as always, have three topics. I don't know why we always... GCSE English told me that everything has to come in threes.
Rule of three, yeah.
Yeah.
It's rhetorically effective.
Yeah, it's actually quite restricting. Sometimes there's not enough news. Although, Parliament's back now, so there is news.
Yes.
Which is quite fun. People are back from their summer holidays. So we're going to be talking about three topics.
We are. One of them is cake-related.
One of them is cake-related, and that is why I had that introduction. Yes, it was deliberate.
Yes.
Trust.
He's looking shifty. we'll come to the cake one in a moment, but we're going to start off by discussing Sean Bailey, who is the Tories' new candidate for the London mayoral race.
It seems very early.
Yeah, it's 18 months away at this point, or more than 18 months away.
Yeah, so he is going to be running against Sadiq Khan.
Yes.
In 2020.
He's seeking re-election.
Yes, he's the current mayor. Have you heard of the only other person who is going to be running for the mayoralty?
No.
Nigel?
Farage?
Yep.
Has he already confirmed? Has he thrown his hat in the
ring?
I mean,
as much as Nigel Farage confirms 100% anything.
Right.
But he's odds on at the bookies that he's like 1 to 25.
Well, I suppose he'll finally be out of...
So put money on Farage.
He'll finally stop being a full-time politician and, you know, his MEP job going away.
Well, so I was reading politics... This is not anything to do with Sean Bailey. But I was reading politics.co.uk, and if we extend Article 50, we're definitely going to have to vote for MEPs next year.
What?
Which will be hilarious, but I'll really enjoy it. Anyway, Sean Bailey is a man of Jamaican descent. He is a son of the Windrush generation. What a wonderful thing that we have two BAME candidates running for the mayoralty from the two major parties. Mm. And we're just going to be talking about how brilliant that is.
Yes.
Right?
So cakes? Well, Sean Bailey, aside from being, as Jazz said, of Jamaican descent, has written quite a lot of things in the past. He was involved with the Centre
Those
for...
are his two defining characteristics.
Yeah,
he's of Jamaican descent and he's written things.
Yeah, well, he has an online footprint. Which is obviously something that's happening more and more frequently with political candidates.
This isn't an online footprint, though. This was a leaflet that was distributed in Kensington, I believe.
Yes, although you can read it online.
It's joyful.
Oh, hang on. I think we're referring to two different things here. Oh. There was a quote-unquote pamphlet from the Centre for Policy Studies.
Yes, in 2005.
Which criticised...
poor people need rules. Women get STIs because they're pretty.
Yeah, I mean, there's a number of comments, and I guess we'll actually say what he said rather than Chaz's unfavourable summaries.
I don't know what you mean.
He's been criticised for saying that girls deliberately fall pregnant so that they can get on benefits and get council house. He's criticised multiculturalism and said that it's sort of undermined sort of faith in the British nation and patriotism and all that sort of thing. And he's also kind of just said that single motherhood is bad in general and that, people should be discouraged from pursuing that as a lifestyle choice. I'm paraphrasing a little bit.
One of us needs to be fair to him, and I'm not sure it's going to be me, Jimmy. You're going to have to rein it in a bit.
I'll read out his comments in full and I'll allow Jazza to comment.
Jazza reacts.
Yeah. But as we've said, it's more than 18 months before the London Mayoral race, and I feel that this is a continuation of the slightly culture warsy debates that happened around Zach Goldsmith's campaign in the previous mayoral elections. But we're going to be discussing all of that.
Great.
So now cake. Jazza, what's happening with cake?
So there was for some reason, everything homophobic in the UK revolves around bed and breakfasts and cakes, and I don't understand why. Why are all of the homophobes concentrated in these two very specific industries? Someone please debunk that and try and explain it to me. But there was a ruling from, there were a couple of evangelical Christian cake makers. You'd think they'd be lovely, but no, they didn't want to make a cake for some gay people getting married. Very annoying, how dare they?
Okay, so that isn't quite what happened.
We'll actually say what it was actually about, because you've read the proper law thing. But
I mean, it wasn't a cake for two gay men getting married, because it was in Northern Ireland where gay marriage is still illegal.
They were asked
to make a cake for a pro-gay marriage political group in Northern Ireland, and they initially said yes before they realised what the design of the cake was, because it was a submit a design and we'll make a cake situation. And then when they realised what the design was, they were like, this clashes with our own beliefs around gay marriage. We believe marriage is between a woman is dictated in the Bible.
So it was a political statement that they were refusing to write
on a cake.
Yes.
Correct. Yes. And initially, they were taken to court by the potential customer, who turned out not to be a customer. And they lost their case, but they appealed it all the way to the Supreme Court in the UK. And the Supreme Court today has ruled in their favour and said that bakeries should not be forced to make cakes containing messages of a political nature that they disagree with.
But does that include... But the question is always, what if a gay couple wanted to get a cake made and the baker says no? Because that's arguably not necessarily a political statement.
That's
what I want to know.
The judgment does actually discuss that, and the...
Oh my God, we'll talk about it.
Yeah, we will talk about it, yeah.
And then finally, Jimmy, are you aware of who Shane Dawson is?
When you pitched this topic to me, I knew zero of the people... who it described, although the name Logan Paul did mean something to me.
Okay, so it's not Logan Paul, it's
I know
Jake
it's not
Paul.
Logan Paul. Okay, but cool. Yeah, cool. I'm aware it's a different Paul.
One of the Pauls. Yeah. One of the Paul brothers. So we are being graced on the internet with an 8-part docuseries, which is kind of edited as if it's, those really cheap horror experiences that you get in seaside towns. It's got all of those kinds of cheap sound effects under the bottom of it. Lots of screeching nails on chalkboards and oh my God. Lots of overreactions, all of that kind of stuff. Shane Dawson has done a load of these profiles of controversial figures on YouTube. Did Jeffree Star, which actually was a really fascinating long documentary. Did Tana Mojo, who did TanaCon, scammed a load of people. Out of a lot of money, and is now doing Jake Paul, who is the brother of the famed Logan Paul, who did the suicide Japanese suicide forest video.
So he went into a forest which is famous for people committing suicide in Japan. But he found a dead body.
But Jake, Logan Paul's brother, is also just a bit of an asshole. Mm. Seems to have... One of the biggest things that they seem to be talking about is the fact that he's plateaued at about 10 million subscribers and is now losing subscribers because he's become more and more unpopular.
We've all been there.
We've all been there.
10 million subs.
Sure. So Shane Dawson is doing this documentary to kind of like, I mean, for views, frankly, but he's hinging the whole thing on, is Jake Paul a sociopath? And I want us to talk about the moral obligations of media producers and mental health professionals to maybe treat psychological disorders with a little bit of respect.
And it is World Mental Health Week / Day.
It is. Something. Oh my God, it is. Yeah, that's why we're doing this topic.
Yes.
Meticulously
planned.
We're going to... I'm basically going to be explaining what this whole shit show is to Jimmy, because he's a granddad and doesn't watch the internet.
Yes.
Cool. Music, money. Hello. So if you've been listening to the podcast for a while, you'll know that we are we rely on you guys in order to keep this podcast going, and we really, really appreciate it. There's a couple of ways that you can support us and make sure that The Right Dishonourable continues to make sporadic episodes. The first one is through our Patreon. You can pledge whatever amount of money that you want if you go to patreon.com/rightdishonourable, and each episode you can give us like a little bit of a tip. And then you can also, if you're into audiobooks, go to audible.com/writedishonorable. And then we get some of the proceeds if you choose to sign up. That's very exciting. But beyond that, enjoy the rest of the show with Jimmy and I. Very exciting. So, Jimmy, we are obviously very happy about the fact that there are we've reached an age where the greatest city in the world, Londinium, is almost inevitably going to be represented by a a person of colour, by somebody of BAME background, for at least the next 6 years. Seeing as Sean Bailey, the Conservative candidate, is the person going up against Sadiq Khan, the former being of Jamaican descent and the latter being of Pakistani descent. There's nothing to worry about the possibility of Sean Bailey, and everything's, it's going to be a nice clean fight, what, isn't it?
Well. I think it's...
Is my optimism misplaced?
Yeah, probably. I mean, it's interesting that, and this is partly why I pitched the topic, but we've already like got into discussions around single parenthood and multiculturalism what is the start of what I think what's going to prove a tediously long mayoral race in London. And the London Mayor doesn't really have a remit over those things. I mean, obviously has, you know, no remit over the benefit system.
Mm-hmm. Yet.
Mm. And probably for a long time, I'd have thought.
They're thinking that, well, I've heard intentions to devolve it. It was part of Osborne's plan to kind of devolve a lot of those kind of council tax things.
Yeah, so George Osborne, the former Chancellor, was big on devolution. And the metro mayors in the north are pushing for more powers kind of across the board. But how long that takes pushing those changes through, I think is debatable. But
I'm sure a long weekend will do it.
I mean, if they can organise Brexit in 2 years.
Yeah, then, exactly, you know. Easy.
But anyway, the end of the last mayoral race was kind of pitched around Zach Goldsmith's, I'm going to use the word divisive, campaign.
It was racist.
Where he tried to depict...
scare Hindu people because Sadiq Khan was going to tax their
jewelry.
And also tried to say that he was an extremist.
Because as a lawyer... Well, not even just as a lawyer. He did meet quite a lot of extreme Islamist figures.
Mm-hmm. But it was his job.
Some of it was because he was a lawyer involved in civil rights cases. I'm not sure all of that was like completely unfair, but the general tone of it was, you know...
It was trying to sway a lot of the South Asian community, which is often very divided among Muslims and non-Muslims. Tried to win over like people from Hindu and people from Sikh and other backgrounds, non-Muslim backgrounds, to vote for Zach Goldsmith because they're Muslims, they can't be trusted.
Yeah, and it does seem as though, not necessarily on the religious point, but we do seem to have picked up where that left off, in terms of like the...
I mean, it's slightly different now. Now I think it's more misogynistic and classist. Although there is a certain amount of like, not specifically Islamophobia yet, but I'm sure we have that to look forward to. Do you want to give us a rundown of what it is that Sean Bailey, the Conservative candidate for Mayor of London... has said that might rub people up the wrong way?
So I don't think I could give a comprehensive rundown, but I can read out some.
I'll chuck some in
greatest hits.
at number 10.
So the first thing that was pulled out, and this has essentially been journalists just going through his online writings and stuff, just picking up on things that he said. Sean Bailey's background, by the way, it was that he was a social worker, and he was also a policy advisor to David Cameron.
But then got fired, and it was all because apparently he wasn't very good at his job. Anyway.
I didn't realise he'd been fired. Anyway, he wrote in a pamphlet for the Centre for Policy Studies, and this was in connection to sort of youth crime levels and stuff like that. Quote, "You bring your children to school and they learn far more about Diwali than Christmas. I speak to the people who are from Brent and they've been having Muslim and Hindi sick days off. What it does is rob Britain of its community. Without our community, we slip into a crime-ridden cesspool." End quote. There is more, but
he seems lovely.
He's basically saying that, I mean, this is a very old-fashioned conservative argument, is that as you remove Christianity and, you know, undermine Britain's Christian roots, you know, break social bonds, etc., etc.
Yeah, sure.
And so that was what he was originally pulled up for.
There's also other stuff that he said in there that is, I mean, kind of less extreme on the, like, misogynist and... less extreme on, like, the xenophobic side of things and anti-Islam.
It is the case that the more diverse countries become, it does weaken social bonds. That is actually something that social scientists do come up with quite a lot, is that it does, to a certain degree, undermine community levels of trust, what social scientists call social capital.
But then you also end up seeing the more diverse communities within those societies end up having more communities cohesion than externally. If you look at studies on like social cohesion in Toronto and in London, they tend to compare more favourably when it comes to like multiculturalism than their more kind of monocultural counterparts in like the sticks.
So you're saying that cities that are, or places that are more multicultural, tend to be more tolerant of multiculturalism than their counterparts?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, that does make sense. But I think that's what Sean Bailey was trying to say, at least the first point.
Yeah, but I mean, come on. Like there is a... I actually don't think there is an awful lot of validity in that argument without sounding xenophobic, because I think it is xenophobic. And it is not the London that exists, especially now in 2018, and not in 2005.
It's a pro-integration argument, isn't it?
It's a pro-assimilation argument, yeah, rather than integration.
Well, yeah.
Okay, so I might get a little soapboxy. Sean Bailey is... he's been called, I think, actually unfairly and somewhat insultingly the token ghetto boy of the Conservative Party in the past.
I mean, the Evening Standard said that recently he's been trolled quite a lot online with, you know, phrases like coconut and that sort of thing.
So I think, which I think is unacceptable and that's not fair. He was called the token ghetto boy in 2010 by his opponent in Kensington, who was... her name's Emma Dent Code, who...
She's an MP now, isn't she?
She's an MP now. She's for one of the Kensington seats. I can't remember which one. But she called him the token ghetto boy. And I know that you probably won't like the fact that I'm pointing this out, but she is a white woman who is married to a knight and went to the Royal College of Music and a private school.
She's posh.
Yeah, she's like super posh, and I'm not sure she should have the right to kind of like throw around the words token ghetto boy very much.
I mean,
anyway.
I don't think people in general should call other people token.
Yeah, I think it's made worse by this. But I think Sean Bailey continues to be used by the Conservative Party, and I think some people will find it unfair that I'm saying used, but he continues to be kind of like a spokesperson because he's the view of like the model working class immigrant in that he believes it, that he should assimilate, and he believes that other immigrants, if only they were more like him and were able to work harder and become British, in this idea of British values that are unmixable with kind of like Islam or with other with other cultural values. He kind of really peddles that idea of, oh yeah, we want immigrants here, but as long as they don't make a fuss and that they're quiet and they don't change anything about the culture that exists here. And I don't think that that is a fair...
That's probably putting it a little bit extremely, but yeah.
I don't know.
He's more of that view than, you know, come here and just be yourself and don't change at all, which is the other extreme.
Yeah, exactly. He also has something that isn't talked about nearly as much from that 2005 pamphlet is what he was saying about class. So he said that the working class need rules. Rules are important to them. Take away the rules and they are left in limbo and they form their own. And then they get into crime. And he's also a man...
I mean, that's also another fairly classic conservative argument that, you know, poorer people are more dependent on rules and structures than richer people.
Yeah, I think that's incredibly patronising. And because there is crime specifically by poor people, that means that it is something that needs to be enforced more. But basically, this is the man who believes in spending less on the poor, but also kind of repressing them more with stricter... policing and stricter rules.
I'm not saying I agree with him. I do. Yeah. He's just, you know, in many ways, most of what he's been pulled up on is classic old school conservatism, really.
I agree.
You know, not put very delicately most of the time.
And I don't think that necessarily flies very well in London very much. But maybe that's because I live in Newham.
So I feel that often we do stereotype London as, you know, this cosmopolitan paradise, whereas actually, you know, 40% of the capital voted Leave. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying all Leavers are totally regressive, but we do 10 more that way.
Well, your words, not mine.
And, you know, I think it's a third of the capital voted for a Conservative candidate in the last general election.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's right. So, you know, there are Conservatives in London. It's not just, everyone's not just a Liberal, but, you know, you obviously need more than 33% of votes in order to win the mayoral race.
Yeah.
So this doesn't, I don't imagine that when he wrote that, he necessarily thought he was going to end up running as London mayor.
I disagree. He's been very clear that he wants to be Prime Minister.
Okay.
Like he's on record saying, I want to be like the first black Prime Minister of the UK.
But those sort of arguments about sort of integration and all of that sort of stuff, I mean, what he said about assimilation, as you put it, is actually less controversial in Britain as a whole, or is more within the mainstream of opinion than it is within London, because London is...
Yeah, exactly, but he is running for the mayor of
London. Yeah, that's why I said I didn't imagine he necessarily wants to be London mayor when he wrote those comments.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I think... In that sense, I think he's a poor candidate, but I think that he probably was selected, you know, he was selected in part because he was black, I'm sure. You know, he was voted for by the Conservative London membership.
About 7,000 people.
Yeah. the two other candidates, I think one was an American woman who's also a London councillor.
Joy Morrissey.
And the other was a... I don't know very much about the other candidate. But, you know, demographically...
I can't read my own writing, but... Andrew is in his name somewhere.
Andrew something, yeah. But, he's a middle-aged white guy. And
give looks like a picture, a classic Tory MP.
Yes.
And that's him.
Yeah, yeah. And Zach Goldsmith, admittedly, before he ran for the London mayor last time.
He used racist tactics, but isn't he attractive? Lovely shoes as well. He always wear very nice loafers.
I mean, you know, regardless of his appearance, before he actually entered the race, he said, "I don't think people want a white male Etonian to run for like the London mayor." Mm-hmm. And then obviously he went and did that.
And before Sean Bailey isn't.
Yeah, he
is. Sean Bailey is like a working class kid who I think he only got 5 GCSEs. He only got 2 A levels. He did go to university, but he went to South Bank University. He is very much of and has like. A working class roots.
He's more normal than Zach Goldsmith.
I mean, objectively.
Yes.
But also, he says all of this. It makes me worried that in order to be able to be kind of like this darling of like the London Conservative Association, you have to have these extreme views. That's what it feels like anyway.
But I mean, ironically, notwithstanding his campaign tactics, Zach Goldsmith is broadly got quite a liberal. Is quite liberal for a conservative. You know, is actually from that socially liberal strand of socially liberal, economically liberal strand of conservatism.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's sort of funny that Sean Bailey has been pulled up on these types of comments specifically.
He also hasn't taken any of them back.
Not really,
which
no.
I think is curious, considering the people that he has to win over.
I mean,
those kinds of comments are only going to gel and get a response from the like hardcore conservatives in London, and he already has their vote. He needs to be tacking to the centre and maybe disowning those comments that he made.
Yeah, I mean that is an interesting point. James Cleverly, who's the deputy chair of the Conservatives and is also mixed race. Sort of apologised for the comments, but then kind of just said, oh, it was put a bit...
On his behalf?
Yeah, on behalf of Sean Bailey. And then kind of just said, oh, you know, the ideas are a little raw.
Mm.
He used the word raw. Kind of saying what I said earlier, they were put indelicately.
Mm-hmm.
And it is actually quite easy to see if you read the pamphlet how it could have been dressed up a bit nicer, saying basically the same thing, but, you know... In not so many words.
Yes, but as a politician, as a representative of London, the words that you choose are probably quite important.
Yes, yeah.
So as a candidate for the job, it's a thumbs down from me, and I will persist in voting for Caroline Pidgeon of the Liberal Democrats.
Really?
Well, yeah, I mean... And then Sadiq number 2, fine.
Yeah, I mean... Do you think that this is going to carry on like throughout? We've got 18 months to go. Do you think it's going to feature around these sort of discussions, or do you think we're going to eventually move on to housing and transport and those sort of issues?
I can see no. I mean, let's be frank. I mean, I also think that the London mayoralty is a lot less powerful than people give it credit for, because it is just kind of like a local mayorship in terms of the power that they have. Like, Sadiq Khan only really has power over, like, transport for London, policing, but then he doesn't get to decide how much money he gets in policing. Council tax, some housing stuff.
I don't think he has control of council tax directly. I might be wrong about that.
Maybe. I think you might be right, actually.
A lot of his role is overseeing, which, you know, I mean, as a, you know, top figure is kind of true anyway, but his direct powers are quite limited, and the main one is transport. I think he has a board role in TfL,
yeah,
so he has quite a lot of influence there, but a lot of other things it's more poking and prodding people and influencing things. And you know, he does have a role as a cheerleader for London more generally.
What do you think of one last thing before we move on? What do you think of Sean Bailey? He at Conservative Party conference called Sadiq Khan showbiz Sadiq, which I thought was a really odd criticism of the man that took over from Boris Johnson.
I mean,
and he's clearly nowhere near as bad as Boris Johnson was.
Is that clear? I feel they're both quite ineffectual
really?
In their own ways.
Really? I don't see Sadiq Khan as a very show busy person.
I don't know, because I think a lot of what he's done... I mean, it's sort of inherent in the role, so I don't know that it is really a criticism of him.
But he's been saying that like he goes to red carpets a lot and all of that kind of stuff, and I don't really see that happening very often. Maybe that's just my interpretation, but it seemed like a really odd criticism from the party that gave us Boris Johnson.
It does seem an odd criticism in that sense, but I mean, it doesn't mean it's untrue. You know, saying he's only half as bad as Boris Johnson is not much of a compliment, as it goes.
Isn't it? I mean... Boris Johnson's pretty bad.
But he's only 50% as bad as Boris Johnson.
Yeah, exactly. And just because there's so much bad, that is quite a lot of a reduction.
That's how proportions work? Still quite a lot of bad, though.
Yeah, no, actually, it's a fair point. So we still might endorse him. Sean Bailey? Yeah, no, we won't. If we get into the business of endorsing candidates. Can we? Oh my God, that'd be fun.
What, like a sort of new statesman leader just before a election takes place?
Yeah.
We often disagree, though. I sort of think it doesn't matter. The role is so limited in its scope, and the manifestos will probably end up being
written
so closely.
It is more symbolic
that it probably doesn't really matter,
to be honest
with you.
So, there you go. Shall we talk about gay cakes?
Yes, we can.
Right, so explain this case to me and what happened and how it ended up at the Supreme Court.
Okay, so this guy went into a bakery in Northern Ireland, Ash's Bakery, and he tried to buy a cake with the... it was with Bert and Ernie. They're Muppets, right? Is that... They're not Muppets, they're Sesame Street.
They are from Sesame Street. Yes.
Bert and ignorant. Sorry, I'm not up on my kids' puppet shows.
It is just a puppet show.
Anyway, this guy, Gareth Lee, went in and bought a cake that had Bert and Ernie on and support gay marriage written on it. And he submitted this as a design, and the Ashers Bakery refused to do that design because they're Christians and therefore they think that gay marriage is immoral. And so producing the cake...
It's not really anything in the Bible that says...
Okay, let's not get theological here. That's what they believe.
Right, sure.
And...
Fine.
So they refused to make the cake. As I said in the intro, they were taken to court by Gareth Lee and the Northern Irish Equalities Commission. And they lost the case. So the judge in the original case found that they discriminated against Gareth Lee directly and indirectly. Firstly, because it was sort of assumed or it was implicit in the judgment that... because he was buying a support gay marriage cake, he must obviously be gay, and that must be like the motivation behind them refusing to serve him. And also, if you bought like, and also that it was obvious. So the direct thing was that it was obvious that Gareth Lee was gay. I don't know if that is true.
That kind of feels irrelevant in the.
Well, that's one of the.
Wait, no, but is it? I have no idea.
So,
go on, please.
So direct discrimination is if you say, you're a gay man, I'm not going to serve you a cake because you're
gay. Yeah, but that never really happens.
It didn't happen in this case.
Okay, cool.
Indirect discrimination, if you buy a support gay marriage cake, you must therefore be gay. That's the indirect part of the discrimination.
Which is silly.
Which is untrue as well.
Yeah.
But that was what it said in the original judgment. Both those points have been overturned in this Supreme Court judgment. But anyway, the Ashers lost their case initially. They appealed it up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court has overturned that and said that if as a baker, somebody comes in and asks you to make a cake with a message on, and you disagree with that message, then you are allowed to refuse service to them, is the salient point in all of this.
Okay, cool. What I want to know is if this has any bearing on whether or not if I am getting married, and Jimmy, you are yet to say yes. But if I am getting married and I go to a baker's and I ask for them to make me a gay wedding cake with two fucking grooms on the top and they say no, can I sue the fuck out of them? Or is this case nothing to do with that?
So if you bought a generic wedding cake that just said, I don't know, happy...
If it was explicitly a gay wedding cake with two grooms on top of it, and that's what made it gay.
Then I think they'd have to serve you, actually.
Okay.
It was the political message. Although I think you're actually right on the boundary line, because if two gay men go into a bakery in Northern Ireland and say, we want to buy a wedding cake, mm-hmm. we're getting married, the Northern Irish bakery, or any bakery across the UK, would have to serve them.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't say, we're not selling you a wedding cake because you're two gay men.
But then, so this is what I thought it was about, and I was obviously wrong because I don't read. But is this not kind of like, they have to serve them a cake, but they can't make it a gay cake, if that makes sense? God, law is stupid.
I think it was the message thing. So the thing is, if you said, we want a wedding cake, and instead of a bride and groom on top, we want two grooms
yeah.
or two brides,
yeah.
I think they'd still have to serve you, although I don't think
but
the
if
judgment...
it says, congratulations, Jazza and Jimmy, on your wedding day,
I think they'd still have to serve you.
Okay.
Yeah, because it the point
P.S. support gay marriage.
Then they wouldn't have to serve you.
Is this only because there isn't gay marriage in Northern Ireland?
No. It's about, I mean, the way the case was sort of judged was against the European Convention on Human Rights, which
yeah.
includes stuff around, I can't remember which article it is in particular.
Right to religion, right to a private
life. It's a
life.
Freedom of conscience, basically.
The European Court of Human Rights strikes again.
I mean,
it's just going to be a shame when that's gone.
The convention, which we will,
sorry,
will
yes.
still be signed up to when we leave the EU, because mm. it's separate from it.
Yeah, but Theresa May does want to take us out of it quite a lot.
Okay. One thing at a time, let her deal with Brexit first.
She's been wanting to do that since like 2013.
She has. But yeah, the point was that you can't be compelled to produce a product or service that actually conveys a message that you disagree with. In this case, support for gay marriage.
All I want to know is if a bakery has to sell me a gay wedding cake, and this isn't conclusive in that, and I'm annoyed.
Judging purely by the press release that I read several hours ago, and scanned briefly,
I'd have to go to.
I think they would have to serve you. Oh. Yeah, I think they would have to serve you because it's the message thing rather than the.
Okay,
cake,
so
know.
What's the? We're going to go to the bakeries, Jimmy. We're going to go hand in hand
in Northern Ireland.
Yeah, I mean, actually, maybe we just find another homophobic bakery. And because maybe this couple have probably been through the mill a little bit. Like, they've had to go to the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
Buy a new suit, get your hair done. It's a lot of effort. Mm. So maybe we find another homophobic bakery. Won't be very hard in Northern Ireland. And then we present ourselves to them, and then we'll see if they say yes or no. That'll be quite exciting.
What would the... But if you buy a cake as a gay couple that is obviously for your wedding, they have to serve it to you, is seemingly the judgment here.
But... I don't think that is the judgment here, is it? Oh, God, I hate
that's,
how
that's
works.
What I understand by
no, it. I understand it as this is purely around political messaging.
Yes.
And not about religion discrimination.
I guess it depends if you think
and, but,
that
and
putting
it's often
two
grooms
on a cake is a political message, or if it's just a
everything.
Cake.
This is a very Oxfordy, wankery, social science-y answer, but everything is innately political.
All right, but the law doesn't think like... Oxford's social scientist, the law thinks
doesn't
in,
it
in more real terms.
Isn't it full of Oxford social scientists?
Yeah, but the law won't be like, oh, what is reality, man? The law will be like, it won't like try and pull the whole house down on us philosophically. It will say, realistically, some, you know, as far as
but
the law,
then, but the, so
as far what, as this legal judgment is concerned, not all things are political.
But this, I feel, only exists. Because this case only exists because in Northern Ireland there isn't gay marriage.
No.
Because otherwise it wouldn't be a political statement.
No, support gay marriage would always have been a political statement. If you went into a bakery in England and tried to get them to make that same cake, the Bert and Ernie one, and they said, no, we can't do that, that is against our political conscience, they'd be within their rights to under this judgment. This is not pure, although it does relate to specific
aspects
of Northern Irish law.
But it's because it's political rather than a celebratory wedding cake.
Yeah, it wasn't. Yeah, because it wasn't a
what if we had to make it rainbow?
I suppose it would depend on the, if it was just incidentally mm-hmm. rainbow or if it was an LGBT flag.
No, it would be the six colours in order of the particular colour code.
Okay. I don't know. I mean, I thought this judgment was watertight, but you've just thrown up loads of examples that I seem to fall within the boundaries, frankly.
Yeah, well, welcome to the law. This is why we wouldn't recommend anybody doing law as an undergrad or a postgrad. Run as fast as you can. Shall we move on?
I think so. I mean, do you, bearing in mind that we do seem to have found examples that flip between the lines, what do you actually think of this judgment? Do you approve of it or do you not approve of it?
It makes sense to me. I don't know. So I kind of think about it as like the right to a platform. Obviously, a cake is not the internet, and a cake is not like Speaker's Corner, and a cake is not like paper. Right, like a way of disseminating information. But actually, in this case, it is a way of disseminating information.
Yeah,
it's simply a vessel for a message. And so, does this actually? I worry that something like this perhaps infringes on freedom of speech, and I think that could be a particular argument that you took.
Yeah. So,
these are the people, this couple have power in that they can create.
They're kind of political. A publisher, aren't they?
Yeah, they're a publisher. Yeah. As soon as you print words or anything with meaning, you're a publisher. And so, well, maybe this needs to be appealed again.
So when this original judgment came out, and it was against the bakers, I'm pretty sure that we between us kind of agreed at the time, because of that platform thing, we said, this is probably a good thing, because the way the original judgment phrased it was, if you're going to produce political messages, you can't discriminate between which political messages that you produce. You have to. So if you're a leaflet shop and a Tory came in, you'd have to print their leaflets.
Yeah, but I remember having this very conversation.
You'd also have to print Labour's leaflets.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's kind of a fairly boring example. But what about the internet, where you've got you're a web hosting provider. You say, I don't want to host your pro-gay marriage website.
But they use the dumb pipes fallacy of just people post whatever they want, but that isn't the case anymore. Now an awful lot of censorship happens both on platform and on the standard internet that exists.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think the thing is, there are examples of web hosting services and other internet services discriminating on the grounds of political content, because you've got have like Stormfront, the neo-Nazi website was kicked off one of its hosting platforms and now has to run its own hosting.
But then what obligation does a private company have to protecting freedom of speech? I don't think they necessarily do. Oh, it's all very confusing.
Yeah. I'm not sure about this judgment. Even though, in some ways I don't think a small bakery really is obliged to publish anything, but I do wonder how it would apply to bigger publishers, and I think that would be more of a problem potentially.
I don't know, if Greggs, for example.
Yeah, Greggs, a chain outlet.
Yeah. I think ultimately people should be allowed to be homophobic in their views as long as it doesn't affect queer people. I'm not going to go into somebody's mind and stop their minds from working. They have come to that conclusion, that is fine. All I want to know is that my existence as a gay man isn't going to be affected by their bigoted opinions.
Depends what you mean by affected, though.
So this is what I mean, right? So I get directly affected if I live in a remote area of the UK and this is the only place I can get a wedding cake to celebrate my gay wedding. My rights to have that gay wedding are backed up in law, that is now law, that I have the right to be able to do this. But they, as a private company, are denying me a service based on my status as a queer person.
So the judgment was quite clear on that point. You can't not sell someone something just because they're gay.
Right. So I am protected, but they're also allowed to be homophobic.
Well, they're allowed to say...
Sorry, they're also allowed to not post pro-LGBT, cake?
So they if you said, I want you to create a pro-LGBT cake, they could say no. If you said, I want to buy a wedding cake for my gay wedding, they'd have to say yes.
This is... I'm not sure that's actually the case.
No, that's absolutely... Is it absolutely the case? That's absolutely what the judge
cool.
says.
Cool, then it's fine. I think... Man, I hate it. Why is it always cakes as well? It's because it's been the same cake for like 5 years.
There was, they actually, in the judgment of the Supreme Court, they referenced the gay cake case in the US as well. So this is a transatlantic phenomenon now.
I wonder if it's also cakes on the European mainland. Cakes specifically.
Yes.
Do you have any questions about Shane Paul? Shane Paul? Shane Dawson interviewing Jake Paul.
So when I read this story, as I said, I didn't really know or care about any of the actors in it. And having read more of the story and discussed it with you briefly, I still don't care. So why should I care? Why is this docuseries, as you put it, about the alleged sociopathy of was it Jake Paul?
Yeah.
Why should I care?
So I have unpopularly been tweeting about this. A lot of people disagree with me, so I thought I'd bring it into our little forum here. I see what Shane is doing on Mental Health Week as grossly immoral and like a breach of American Psychological Association guidelines. The reason I bring in the APA is because he has brought in the help of a qualified therapist YouTuber who has about like a couple of hundred thousand subscribers called Katie Morton, who he has brought in to basically talk about sociopathy, which makes it, I'm not going to call it that. I'm for what is actually called, where is it? The name is antisocial personality disorder.
Yeah, so sociopathy is like a colloquialism. It's not a real, it's not a recognized medical condition.
It's not what you would look up in a medical journal. You'd look for ASPD.
And Shane Dawson does reference the, is it Diagnostic Statistical Manual, the DSM?
Yes. Katie Morton does.
Right, and that's the mental health Bible for psychiatrists and psychologists.
And she, as a mental health professional, frankly should know better, because she is being, she has allowed Shane Dawson to be sensationalist around antisocial personality disorder, has given people cherry-picked information about a very serious disorder that affects about 4% of the population in the US, is the statistic. It's 1 in 25 people.
Oh, the antisocial personality disorder,
yeah.
Is it?
Yeah, 1 in 25 people are sociopaths, is like the quote that she gives. Which is then going to mean that an awful lot of young, impressionable people who do not understand that this is entertainment, even though there is a disclaimer at the beginning of every episode, that is not something that people are going to be reading and taking into consideration seriously. This is going to end up with a lot of people flippantly throwing around accusations of mental health disorders around the playground.
So what does this mental health, how does the...
So the biggest thing is that Katie Morton has been brought in they interview Jake Paul.
Okay, but necessary context, what does that disorder actually mean in practice?
It means a lack of ability to empathise and to have concern for other people, but also concern for yourself.
Right.
And is often portrayed like very negatively, but there was a YouTuber called who goes by the name of Faye System, who has ASPD and talks about it really articulately. One of the annoying things is that Shane Dawson cherry picks from that video that Faye System made to sensationalise it, also like with music and load of these sound effects but like horror music in the background, being like, sometimes these people struggle to empathise with people, dun dun dun, all of that kind of stuff. But the biggest problem I have, like, I think broadly hinging this whole thing on Jake Paul around whether or not, literally the question he's answering is Jake Paul a sociopath, despite the fact that in the first episode he has a conversation with his cameraman where the cameraman points out that, well, you don't know, you've never met Jake Paul and you don't know anything about sociopathy or being a sociopath, but you're asking the question and accusing him of being a sociopath. Like, it's so misguided, and I keep on using immoral, but I think it's just irresponsible I think is the biggest problem that I have with it. But then also Katie Morton, who should know better as a mental health professional, is surreptitiously being smuggled in to be around Jake Paul and his people when they're filming this documentary with him. Not explicitly so that she can give a diagnosis, but so that she can observe him, but then give kind of like her opinions on the diagnosis, and that is close enough to a diagnosis for me. And that is grossly, grossly immoral to psychologically assess somebody without their consent. And and she, frankly, should have her license taken away in the state of California.
So the APA does have a rule whereby you're not supposed to diagnose remotely.
Yes, which, to be fair, she hasn't done.
Yes.
What she is breaching is medical guidelines where you have to have the consent of the patient to be able to be diagnosed.
Right.
And the fact that she is being smuggled in, they're saying that she's a producer and she's there to observe. A lot of people are splitting hairs about this, but medically there is there's like a clear breach of moral judgment here.
I mean, it's not really a medical question, though. It's more a journalistic one, isn't it? I would say it's kind of journalism, what he's doing.
Yeah, so I think that the Shane Dawson question is a journalistic one, and I think it's one of the reasons that I kind of miss gatekeepers a little bit.
Right.
Because something like this would never be... something like this would never be... have this kind of a tone around a mental disorder that 1 in 25 people have. That sensationalizes it.
I think you're massively overestimating the ethics of the gatekeepers.
Yeah, no, like perhaps.
Yellow press and
but
all
to,
that sort of
But
thing.
To say, like, it's like a... the way that it's edited and the way it's put out makes it sound like a witch hunt.
Hmm.
1 in 25 people around you, and that's one person in your class. That's like 20 people at your school. And all of those kinds of really sensationalist things I think are really irresponsible and damaging to be putting out there.
Are they, though? I mean, people will watch this video and forget most of it by, you know, in a month's time.
I mean, sure. Actually, no. Millions and millions of people are watching this.
Yeah, and they'll...
like 10 to 20 million people, most of them young people.
And
most of them
will
teenagers.
Forget most of it by, you know, in a couple of months' time.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean that it won't have an impact on them.
I guess so, yeah, but it... I don't know, it does sound bad, and I won't watch it because I'm frankly not interested in the content of it.
I've been doing a lot of data entry, it's been on in the background.
But, I mean, I think... it does sound bad, but I think he's got a right to make it, and, you know.
I agree he has a right to make it, but I would, like, if I knew the guy, I'd be thoroughly disappointed in the tone that he's chosen to... like, he didn't have to sensationalise it and hinge it around Jake Paul possibly being a sociopath.
I mean, sociopath's not a medical diagnosis anyway, so in a sense...
No, but exactly. But know. Then he gets Katie Morton to read out the ASPD definition and says, are sociopaths? And like, and she is saying that they're sociopaths and keeps on using the term.
Okay.
And I think that is... it's irresponsible. I just wish people would grow up.
It does sound irresponsible. I mean, what about... Jake Paul's behaviour has prompted this.
Because he's a fucking nutter and a show-off.
Right.
But then there's also bits of the documentary where Shane Dawson's like, are all YouTubers sociopaths? Ah. He does that noise sometimes. Like, Jake Paul is a bit of an arsehole. He's an attention seeker. Has been accused of bullying an awful lot in the past. Has a very public, kind of like weird relationship with his parents. And with his brother, and he's just kind of like an overactive, really, he seems like an angry, unstable young man, to be completely honest, for a lot of the kind of stuff that he does. There hasn't been a conclusion yet, and Jake Paul only turns up after about 4 hours of video.
Yeah.
So he turns up in the fifth episode.
How long
so
is this series in hours?
There's going to be eight, so there's
eight
three
hours.
More.
8 hours?
It will end up being between 6 and 7, I think. Because each video is about 45 minutes.
Oh.
But yeah, I worry about... it makes me wish for... there to be more adults in the room when it comes to this kind of a thing.
I guess,
and I feel like that more and more about YouTube, and it makes me depressed a little bit.
So my question to round off this topic then is, what responsibility do you think that YouTube has to stop these kind of videos being uploaded? Does it have any?
I think that there is a double standard where I can't swear in a video without being demonetized and ending up not having my content pushed out across the site. But he is allowed to peddle really quite damaging cherry-picked information about people with a mental disorder, and he'll be fine because he's in a preferred partner program.
Mm.
And I think that that is a double standard that is not perhaps as nuanced. And me putting it like that makes it sound like I'm like jealous of his success, frankly. That's what really kind of worries me about some of the people who are the most successful on the site, who, though they don't breach the guidelines of YouTube, are still morally questionable. But in order to adhere to the site, like, they tick all of the boxes and so continue to have lucrative careers where I think they actually do an awful lot of damage to society.
I mean, do you think someone at YouTube, I mean, we could even broaden this to Twitter or Facebook or whatever, should have kind of moral editorial control then, in some sense? So, you know, should they be monitoring? They do this to some extent anyway, because they take down terrorist videos and that sort of thing.
But, well, they take down LGBT videos sometimes incorrectly.
But
because so there is moral judgment there.
But should the moral judgment pare down to even, you know, stuff like this, you know, mental health related videos?
Yeah, I don't know.
But
it is frustrating for that double standard to exist.
I mean, yeah, but I think in practice, you know, you could come up with criteria that would eliminate this video or would stop these sort of videos being posted. But
then it would probably catch a lot of very positive videos.
Well, it would probably catch a lot of stuff that's a lot more marginal or is a lot more debatable, and that, you know, that carries its own risks as well.
But the fact, like, I keep on thinking about like the BBC test or the broadcaster test.
Mm.
Like, the BBC or Channel 4 or ITV or Sky would never put out something about a mental health disorder that affects such a large portion of the population with this kind of a tone, because it would be seen as morally irresponsible. And Shane Dawson is reaching more people than those companies.
Mm.
And it makes me sound like an old Luddite fart, but that worries me to a certain extent.
I guess I'm not very convinced by this whole moral responsibility metric. I think it's actually, even though in this case it does seem quite clear cut, I think generally I'm not really sure who's making that judgment, on what criteria are they making that mm-hmm. judgment. I think it's actually very hard to come up with.
Yeah, but I think it's because of a lack of adults in the room, and a lack of people who actually experience these things, and a lack of a desire to actually spend money on, like, consultants to be able to talk about those kinds of things properly.
I think it's just
and also the chasing of views.
Yeah.
And it just makes me feel a little bit gross, because this is the kind of stuff that YouTubers get labelled with, as opposed to an awful lot of the really positive stuff that's on the site.
Mm.
And it's a lot more serious than just Shane Dawson making a video. I think there are real life consequences to it.
You could say that about quite a lot of media. It's contentious.
So, yeah.
You know, I think,
I don't think we're nearly as responsible as we should be about our content, seeing the huge numbers who listen to us.
I mean, you could argue, we've definitely said false information.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, despite your fear of libel.
If, well, you know, I don't think we've said, we probably have said defaming things, but...
we definitely have.
But, you know, in some ways, we've probably caused small amounts of harm by things we've said on this podcast. It's probably hard to run any sort of publication or podcast or whatever without causing some kind of harm.
You know? Yes.
I don't...
Oh, my God, the yoke of responsibility, it leans heavy on my shoulders. Shall we wrap up?
Yes.
Where can they find you on the internet, Jimmy?
You can find me at JDE Nichols on Twitter. Would never host something as barbaric as this Shane Dawson.
No, heaven forbid. And you can find me at Jazza John. Follow the Sentient Podcast, Right Dishonourable, which we say all the time, but
at
also
Right Dishonour.
At Right Dishonour.
Yeah.
Oh, whoopsie. And also just share
Share far and wide, but share responsibly. Don't send it to anyone who might get confused. if you have any like thick relatives who might struggle to follow along, don't send it to them. That could end up in bad consequences. Yes.
Wow. Okay. Thanks, Jimmy. Right. See you later.